and was underway at the International Amphitheater. 10,000 protesters filled the streets, chanting, "The whole world is watching," and clashing with cops. After the gig, Griffith and a local friend went to check out if the riots were as bad as the TV coverage made it seem. Griffith watched in shock as the police rushed a crowd, bashing them with batons. A white man stumbled away, holding his bloodied head and yelling, "Oh my God! They're hitting us like we're niggers!" The Bagatelle did not survive Chicago. Half the band decided to go to New York to try and start under a new name, while the other half headed for California. All of them were tired, not just of the Boston sound, but of Boston itself. Griffith went with the California crew. When you get out of Chicago, the whole landscape just blows out and opens you up, he says. The band drove west through Iowa and Nebraska, then decided to visit New Mexico. West and then south, the Bostonians kept driving farther and farther from home. Everybody was still, like, a little uptight because we'd experienced some bad vibes and racial shit in the Midwest. But then that sign for New Mexico comes up, the land of enchantment. You pass over the border, man, and it was like that knot in your stomach went away. Everything relaxed. We get into Santa Fe, and everybody said, "This is it. This is it for me." Chapter 5 The White Light Underground. My other big record of the day was White Light, White Heat. Lester Bangs, Astral Weeks. But what if there really was a Boston sound? Something truly revolutionary, a music evocative of the city from which it sprang. Critic Wayne McGuire believed it existed. In August 1968, he published a manifesto in Crawdaddy, arguing that two musicians were actually creating it. It is irrelevant that the Velvet Underground first received significant exposure in their home city, New York, with Andy Warhol's Exploding Plastic Inevitable. It was in Boston, through record sales and Boston Tea Party performances, that they began to find some acceptance and meaningful response, like getting their equipment stolen. It is irrelevant that Mel Lyman's present instrument is avatar and film, not music. What is relevant is that these two voices best express the character and spirit of the forces at work in Boston, home of the first American Revolution. It is a character and spirit which in the near future will make Boston the center of the second American Revolution, a revolution of the spirit. The Velvet Underground's Lou Reed and the Guru of Fort Hill would seem to be polar opposites. But in strange articles like McGuire's and a rock palace called the Boston Tea Party, the two briefly converged. At 53 Berkeley Street, the Velvets found a second life as a band, playing the club 43 times between 1967 and 1970, versus only three shows in their home base, New York. There the band transformed from an Andy Warhol factory novelty into a musical force. One night after a chaotic MC5 set in which someone urged the crowd to tear down the hall, Reed took the stage and pledged his allegiance. "This is our favorite place to play in the whole country, and we would hate to see anyone even try to destroy it." The Velvet Underground's favorite venue would never have existed had it not been for Mel Lyman and the Fort Hill community. Jesse Benton was born in Kansas City, Missouri in 1939. The daughter of painter Thomas Hart Benton, Jesse enjoyed an artistic, celebrity-filled upbringing. When a certain movie star stayed at the Benton residence for a time, posing for her father, she fell head over heels. "I stayed in love with Marlon Brando for the rest of my life," Benton said. "Who wouldn't? He noticed me," and liked my father. Both Thomas and his wife Rita revered traditional American music, and Jessie learned guitar at an early age. Her first job was singing at the Ocean View Hotel on Martha's Vineyard, where the family spent their summers. When Edward R. Murrow brought his person-to-person interview program to the painter's house in 1955, a 19-year-old Jessie performed the Turtle Dove song on dulcimer for a national TV audience. Jessie Benton recalled an idyllic upbringing, especially those summers on Martha's Vineyard, where none of the island's residents made a fuss about her father's controversial public persona, or batted an eye when the family skinny-dipped in the ocean. A self-declared enemy of modernism, Benton was criticized for the ethnic stereotypes in some of his murals in the 1930s, and was fired in 1941 from his teaching position at the Kansas City Art Institute for homophobic remarks. As a child, Jessie immersed herself in Greek mythology, and for several years believed she was secretly Persephone, Zeus's daughter, the beautiful queen of the underworld, and also the subject of one of her father's most revered paintings. Showing a reporter around the Benton's Island property in 2012, she dreamily gazed over the landscape and declared, "This was our world." With her striking looks and confidence, she exerted a powerful force. "We engaged Jessie to sit with our 2 4-year-olds," said one vineyard resident. "It was strange that both fathers awoke early on the days Jessie was to come, and soon appeared shaved and sporting combed locks." She attended Radcliffe College in the late 50s, just as Harvard Square's folk scene was blossoming. On Martha's Vineyard, she met David Goode, a recording engineer who exerted an influence on other young island musicians like James Taylor and Carly Simon. Goode and Benton married on New Year's Eve, 1962, at St. Francis Xavier's Church in Kansas City. They had a son, Anthony, and though it would be years before she obtained a divorce, Jessie freely dated other men throughout the early 60s. One such suitor was Robert Peter Cohen, who would become a successful character actor as Peter Coyote. In 1964, he was an artistic young man with interests in everything from political activism to mime work to Jessie Benton. She was a natural aristocrat, haughty and achingly beautiful, blessed by her Italian mother with dark, tangled hair and a Caravaggio mouth. Her unerring instinct for the first rate and the precision of her dismissive ridicule invigorated any room she entered, charging the atmosphere and alerting people to impending adventure or disgrace. Her behavior was restless and bold, and her natural incandescence made others pale by comparison. Her gifts were so abundant that her peers, the best and the brightest of Radcliffe and Harvard, seemed to accept as just her uncontested status as reigning queen. Coyote persuaded her to move to San Francisco with Anthony, but Benton returned east every summer to Martha's Vineyard to be with her family. One night during the summer of 1965, she tried LSD for the first time. It was the same night Goode brought Mel Lyman to the Benton house. Lyman walked into the living room and confidently assessed the huge portrait of an 18-year-old Jessie holding a guitar painted by her father. "That doesn't look anything like you," Mel bluntly told Jessie. "That looks like a frog." Jessie had never cared for the portrait herself and was immediately fascinated by the first person to ever criticize it. "He was like something I had never seen or known ever," Benton says. "He really was like something from another planet." Jessie's first LSD trip was a bad one, but Mel stayed by her side throughout the 48-hour psychedelic breakdown, singing and reading her his poetry. When she finally came out of it, she promptly called Peter Coyote and told him to send her things. "I found God, and I'm moving in with him," she said. The new couple moved into their first home on Fort Hill in early 1966. Securing a divorce from Goode to marry Lyman would take some doing. She was going to need a good lawyer. Now in his 80s, the accidental architect of Boston's alternative media landscape currently lives in Lawrence, Kansas. At the time, I was one of the most famous people in Boston, Ray Reepin Crows. Reepin would say hello and voila, a 400-word feature, the Boston Globe noted, tongue-in-cheek. In the late 60s, Reepin was known as the hippie entrepreneur because he opened the Boston Tea Party, started the freeform phase of radio station WBCN, and bankrolled the pioneering alternative weekly, the Cambridge Phoenix. Though all three institutions are now defunct, Reepin's business moves in the late 60s and early 70s resonated in Boston for decades. How did a 30-year-old Kansas City lawyer trigger a cultural transformation 1,400 miles away? The chain of events started when he went out on a few dates with fellow Kansas City native Jesse Benton. The evenings would end with Reepin bringing Jesse home and getting drunk on bourbon with her father. In the summer of 1966, Reepin and Benton connected again, as she was trying to figure out how to legally split from David Goode. According to Benton, things with her estranged husband were amicable, but Reepin suggested that manufacturing a record of ill will would expedite the legal proceedings. Lacking in actual indignity, Reepin staged one. He had Benton dial Goode and ask if he was interested in getting back together. Goode unloaded, counting the ways she had hurt him. Most people are too busy socializing to read the law anymore, but indignities can occur by the phone, and that was the grounds we used to file, Reepin explains. Benton got her divorce, but she and David didn't drift physically far from each other. In fact, shortly after Benton and Lyman married and moved up to Fort Hill, Goode settled in next door with his new love interest, Faith Frankenstein. The four of them would constitute the founding members of the Fort Hill community, a number that would steadily rise. 20 or more adults, 9 to 12 children, some cats, 2 houses, 7 apartments, lots of cars, a badly battered Revolutionary War monument, and one of the loveliest views of the city, read the first Globe profile the following year. With a new wife and free of his musical duties in Jim Kweskin's jug band, Mel turned his attention to what he believed would be his great artistic medium, experimental films. Lucky for Mel, he had briefly roomed with one of the titans of the form, Jonas Mekas. A Lithuanian immigrant, Mekas had helped publish an anti-German newsletter back home. After his typewriter disappeared from its hiding place inside a stack of firewood, he fled to the United States, and within weeks of arriving, he and his brother Adolphus rented a Bolex 8mm camera. In 1964, he established the Filmmakers Cinematheque, a peripatetic Manhattan institution that built its fan base and notoriety with artists like Stan Brakhage, Jack Smith, and Andy Warhol. Ronna Page, who acted in Warhol's Chelsea Girls and later joined the Fort Hill community, introduced Mekas to Mel Lyman. They met at her favorite hangout in Manhattan, the Paradox Restaurant, New York City's first macrobiotic eatery, where you could sit and watch Yoko Ono and others climb into a bag as conceptual art. When he learned that Lyman needed a place to stay, Mekas put him up for a few weeks. "I'm not one of those people that asks too many questions about where you've come from," Mekas says. During that time, Lyman saw how Mekas was always filming something, often with no expressed purpose or endgame. "You just do it," Mekas told Lyman, who was worried that filmmaking was too complicated. That opened their eyes to possibilities, he says. They got a camera and started fooling around. Fort Hill community member George Pepper felt inspired by the burgeoning DIY genre as well, and itched to start a Boston offshoot of the Cinematheque. "I will help with films and suggest programming, but you do everything else," the busy Micahs told Pepper. It's your baby. At the precise time, Pepper was searching for a way to open a Boston Cinematheque. He picked up a skinny hitchhiker in Cambridge named David Hahn. A 22-year-old MIT dropout just back from a business venture in Honduras, Hahn wanted to construct an experimental light show to see what happened when the mind is overloaded with stimuli, a vision that fit with Pepper's. They scouted locations, landing on the Magna Building at 53 Berkeley Street in the South End, most recently home to a coffee house called the Moondial. It seemed perfect, but the lease was much more than they could afford. Jesse Benton knew someone from back home, now in Boston, to attend Harvard, who might be able to help. She called Ray Reepin with some exciting news. Warhol and Micahs wanted to do a Boston division of the Filmmakers Cinematheque. According to Benton, the two notorious filmmakers had a location, but they couldn't tie it up just yet. Would Ray help them secure the property? After 5 years practicing law in Kansas City, Reepin had just come to Harvard for a master's degree, living in Somerville. She told me the Ford Foundation was backing the Filmmakers Cinematheque, and they were about to make a decision to come to Boston, he recalls. Therefore, Reepin's monetary investment would be temporary, but he'd be permanently connected to something très chic. He picked up a shirt off the floor, put on one of his three-piece suits, and drove without a license down to 53 Berkeley Street to check the place out. Reepin walked around the building with George Pepper and Hahn. To this day, you'll hear people involved with the Boston Tea Party, Reepin included, identify the place as a former synagogue due to the prominent Star of David-shaped window. This is incorrect. The building was constructed in the early 1870s as a Unitarian meeting house, and the stellar glass likely symbolizes the unity of all religions. Up a steep flight of stairs inside the main room was an altar stage, behind which was a phrase written in the shape of a rainbow on the wall, "Praise ye the Lord." For reasons he still doesn't fully understand, Reepin put up his own money to secure the lease. 2 weeks later, Benton called Reepin with some bad news. The grant money had fallen through. Micahs recalls the Ford Foundation grant in question, but doesn't believe it was ever slated for anything in Boston. Jesse Benton doesn't recall the grant at all. Reepin now held the lease to an abandoned synagogue. This was not an ideal situation for a frugal man from Kansas City attending grad school without a current source of income. After meeting Pepper's new hitchhiker friend, he felt he had found someone he could work with. Reepin made David Hahn a co-owner of the operation. There were rumors that Hahn had driven up from Honduras with a trunk of gold bricks he had acquired in South America, but regardless of what his actual source of disposable income was, Hahn was able to make up the other half of the money needed to keep the Tea Party's doors open. Under Fort Hill guidance, the Boston Cinematheque was ready to roll. But Reepin knew ticket sales to kooky flicks wouldn't cover costs, especially if Warhol wasn't actually involved. Reepin thought he could give some dances to help pay the rent, and Benton came up with the idea of opening a store as well. The Fort Hill contingent went to work, opening a shop on the second floor called Moon in Leo that dispensed hodgepodge hippie wares. Eben Given hand-painted names of FHC heroes on the wall next to the street-level staircase. Visitors passing names like Prometheus, Edison, and Lao Tzu must have wondered what exactly they were walking into. Reepin came up with the club's name while sitting at Jim Queskin's kitchen table. Tea is code for dope, he points out. Then awe shucksed his way through the straight-laced city's entertainment licensing process. I just want to give a dance or two for the kids on the weekends, he'd tell the person behind every desk with a manufactured air of naivete. He pretended to stumble through the process and made under-the-table payments when required. Everybody in Boston was on the take, Reepin claims. In the coming years, Reepin tried to mark these payments down on his tax returns. You can't put $78,000 a year down for police payoffs, his accountant said, aghast. You'll end up in the trunk of your car. At first, the schedule was fairly simple. The Fort Hill community would screen films at the Cinematheque all week long, then turn the reins over to the tea party for the weekend. Lyman immediately started making soundtracks for some of the silent pictures and adding live-action flourishes to others, such as when the Fort Hill gang sat at a table and ate a full meal while Warhol's Harlot played behind them to the director's delight. Despite being the connection that made the Cinematheque possible, Jesse Benton went to only one screening, whereupon she watched a long close-up of a vagina for 20 minutes before deciding these films weren't for her. In the first Globe story on the venue, the entire endeavor is presented as the work of the Fort Hill community. Reepin's name isn't even mentioned. The wedding of the Cinematheque and the Boston Tea Party was almost a happenstance thing, but the people involved in the two projects, imbued as they were with astrological astuteness and a sensitivity to the cosmic forces of the stars, are not surprised. This version of the story wouldn't last long. Within a few months, Reepin would dominate every Tea Party story, and the Cinematheque would fade out of the picture completely. But in those early days, Ray and the FHC were unlikely collaborators. He recalled occasionally visiting Fort Avenue Terrace to see what life was like up there. "That was not my scene," he says. Mel Lyman would organize his group by giving them acid at dinner, and then taking them up in the attic and telling them how much he loved them. He did that with a lot of people, and a lot of people who were fairly bright stayed with him. I was very paranoid about it. I practically took my own taster to dinner there. When an interviewer asked Lyman why the Cinematheque closed, he claimed it was because the Tea Party contingent was out to make money. "We'd like to make money, too, but we don't want to stop doing what we love to do. We don't put that first." He then revealed what was really taking up most of Fort Hill's time, an underground newspaper that had just published its first issue under the name Avatar. On January 20, 1967, the Boston Tea Party held its first rock and roll concert, or as Reepin had presented it to city officials, a dance for the kids. Local legends, The Lost, on the verge of splintering into three different Bosstown Sound units, were the triumphant headliners. For Rolling Stone, it was without a doubt the most important date in Boston rock and roll history. David Hahn had hired all manner of local freaks and geeks to produce a psychedelic atmosphere inside. Scott Bradner, who worked at Harvard, came across an old sensory deprivation chamber on campus, a giant hemisphere that would enclose a human from the waist up. He borrowed it and built the venue's all-important strobe light inside. The strobe, in combination with overhead projectors and color organs, transformed the Tea Party from a cavernous church room into a disorienting hallucinogenic playground. One visual technician at the club recalled how attendees would come in and say, "Turn on the strobes," then whirl around and fall on the floor. This was a safe place to temporarily lose your mind. The city had never seen anything like it. The Boston Tea Party's concert room had an otherworldly ambiance, according to the employees, musicians, and audience members who were there. By all accounts, it was a space where people from all walks of life could mix without tension. According to Fred Griffith of the Bagatelle, at that time, if you went to South Boston, you could get your ass kicked. But people were getting together at the Tea Party from all over the city. I never saw a fight there. MIT students were becoming friends with members of biker gangs. Even with my pessimism, I was saying, wow, maybe people can get along. I thought it was the future. Press coverage was generous and steady. Harvardians, hippies, cyclists, stray sailors, tuned-up insurance company drones all gyrate with the bliss of children, the Globe drooled. By the time city officials realized that Reepin was doing a lot more than throwing weekend dances for the kids, it was too late. The club was a phenomenon. Reepin now wondered how he might make some real money off the place. With the hefty rent and his partner David Hahn taking home half the profits, he wasn't exactly raking it in. A few months into 1968, Reepin bought out Hahn and became the sole owner of the Boston Tea Party. The last time I saw David was on top of Fort Hill, George Pepper says. After we talked, he ran back down toward his house, but turned back to me and said, "Tell everyone that I love them so much." Hahn returned to Honduras. In 1976, he dove under his ship, the Olive Oil, had a heart attack, and never resurfased. Van Morrison first appeared on the Tea Party stage during a hallucination set. In late May 1968, Peter Wolf's band opened for John Lee Hooker 3 nights in a row. On the third night, Wolf invited his new friend to sing with the band. "We've been doing Gloria for some time, even before it was a popular thing to do," Wolf explained in 1973. When an inebriated Morrison joined the Hallucinations to perform the song he wrote, the audience was aghast. Up comes Van Morrison doing this whole crazed show, talking Japanese for 35 minutes into the microphone, Wolf said. He recalled an unintentional mashup, Morrison singing Mean Old World as the Hallucinations played Gloria. Wolf admonished the confused audience, "Don't you know who this man is? He wrote the song." Later that night, Tea Party manager Steve Nelson drove Wolf, Morrison, and Hooker home in the club's VW bus. The trio had a lot to talk about, but between the booze and the accents, Nelson couldn't make out a single word. Getting drunk rock stars home safely was one of Nelson's easier Tea Party tasks. Keeping the police and licensing commission from shutting the club down turned out to be far more laborious. For the opening weekend of 1968, the Harvard Law School grad had booked a strong bill of locals, and word of mouth helped make the Saturday crowd double the previous nights. As 500 people danced and zoned out to the sounds of Cloud, the house lights came on. It was a raid. The band petered out as Dapper O'Neill, a loud-mouthed old-school conservative who was on the city's licensing board, came jogging up the stairwell to the second-floor stage, a dozen police officers in tow, certain that he'd find drugs everywhere. Nelson watched them fan out to search the premises. A police detail was already at every show, so the clientele sort of knew to come to the shows high. The underground press helpfully prescribed such etiquette. "Nobody minds you going zonked," Broadside of Boston advised, "but leave the stuff at home. If one person gets busted, the place is closed. Licenses don't grow in fields." Dapper O'Neill made his way to the balcony and cast his eyes upon a floor littered with empty plastic casings. The Devil's Disciples, a motorcycle gang, liked to watch the action from up here, inhaling amyl nitrate poppers for quick head rushes. But now all that remained was the packaging. He had brought a Boston Herald Traveler reporter along for the big drug bust. Now what? Dapper stormed back downstairs and grilled Nelson. Did he have a valid license to operate? Nelson produced it. In desperation, Dapper spun around and saw a frightened young woman working the soda pop station. He walked slowly toward her. "How about the pop?" he barked. Later that week, Dapper O'Neill hauled Reepin and Nelson into court for the one thing he found amiss at the Boston Tea Party, an expired soft drink license. "Your Honor," Reepin explained to the judge, doing his hayseed routine, We're just trying to keep kids off the streets of Boston, is all. Give them something to do. Reepin, in one of his signature three-piece suits, was right at home, walking back and forth in front of the judge, putting on a performance of blissful innocence. Now, if I knew there was a problem with our soft drink license, you know I would have corrected it right away. This is merely an oversight, and by no means a sign of managerial ineptitude. Then, with the professional timing of an old vaudeville routine, Reepin and Nelson recounted the overblown raid on the club in vivid detail. The judge forced a furious Dapper to apologize to Reepin and Nelson right there in the courtroom. His florid face turned even redder. Soda pop raid fizzles, blared the next day's Boston Herald Traveler. Dapper kept looking for ways to get the club in trouble, even harassing the Tea Party for plastering the city with flyers that featured the word psychedelic. But for the most part, Nelson and Reepin made sure there was nothing to complain about. One occasion in late 1968 deserves a note. When Fleetwood Mac played past the city's curfew, policemen walked on stage and unplugged their amps. Two kids in the crowd, Tom Hamilton and Joe Perry, soon to start a band called Aerosmith, watched in horror as the kick-ass set was cut short. Jonathan Richmond grew up in the suburb of Natick, but whenever his father wasn't using the family car for his job as a traveling salesman, Richmond would flee his neighborhood to soak up the sounds of the city. "When I was 16," he said, "I heard the music of the Velvet Underground, and everything changed for me." One spring afternoon in 1967, while loitering in Harvard Square, he saw someone walking down the street that he recognized from photographs. "Excuse me? Are you Lou Reed?" Richmond asked. "Yeah," answered Reed, taken aback. Richmond looked like he could have been one of the little rascals. This was not the kind of person Reed would have suspected to be a fan of his decadent art rock band named after a book about sexual fetishes. "I heard your record," Richmond said, "and I love the sound you get." "Really?" asked Reed. "Yeah, for example, the way you use the guitars like they were drums," Richmond explained. "Wait a minute," Reed said. "Are you saying we use rhythm guitar tracks as percussion instruments?" He was beaming. "That's what we do. You heard that?" The next day, as he had done in the past, Richmond showed up at the Boston Tea Party at 4 p.m. with a hand-painted poster commemorating that night's show. He offered to give the poster to the club if he could slip in early and bypass the age restrictions. Inside, members of his favorite band seemed to already know who he was. "They grasped how seriously I took the music," Richmond later explained. "It was life or death serious. It still is for me. If music isn't life or death serious, I don't want to do it. I wasn't a musician yet. The Velvet Underground made me a musician." Today, Richmond is a beloved singer-songwriter with a singularly eccentric point of view and disarming delivery. Unlike non-native sons like Morrison and Reed, he's composed countless odes to Boston and New England, beginning with his masterpiece, Roadrunner. It's a gleeful proto-punk classic, the only rock song that Johnny Rotten claimed not to hate. It's also a gloriously goofy reinterpretation of VU's epic Sister Ray, a song that was released right as the teenage Richmond was getting to know the band. In Vibrations, a local Crawdaddy knockoff, Richmond published a rambling love letter to the group titled New York Art and the Velvet Underground, complete with a hand-drawn graph whose Y-axis spans death to God, and which charts VU's progress against groups like the Rolling Stones and Jimi Hendrix. Only the Beatles beat the Velvets in the upward crest toward Godhead. A few weeks after Richmond met Lou Reed, his father returned home from work with an unsold bingo prize for his son, a junky $10 guitar. Soon after its inception, the Boston Tea Party had to compete with imitators. Over in a factory space in Brighton Center, a student named Ken Keyes launched a venue called the Crosstown Bus, with a series of summer concerts culminating with an appearance by The Doors in August 1967. At the time of booking, the band was on the rise. As showtime neared, Light My Fire was already a giant radio hit. Reepin wondered if the Tea Party was doomed to be swallowed up by competitors. He had an idea. If he could persuade Andy Warhol to turn the Tea Party's weekend of Velvet Underground concerts into a movie starring the audience, that would be a bigger splash than Jim Morrison and company headlining at Crosstown Bus. He called Warhol and said, "Listen, you son of a bitch, I'm the guy that's keeping the Velvet Underground alive here, and you've got to do me a favor and play like you're shooting a movie." Curiously, Warhol agreed, though timelines placed this weekend after the Velvet Underground fired him as manager. Reepin reportedly told the artist he didn't even care if the camera was empty. The notion of shooting a movie would suffice. "You are the star. You are what's happening. Be a part of Boston's first authentic underground movie," read the flyer touting Warhol's name. For plugged-in members of Boston's counterculture, suddenly a very difficult choice had to be made on August 11, 1967. According to Reepin, Crosstown Bus associates drove by the Boston Tea Party to revel in their victory, only to find a line of women from Dedham in poochie dresses 3 blocks long, standing in the rain trying to get in Andy Warhol's next movie, as Reepin put it. Shortly after the Doors left town, Crosstown Bus stalled for good. For decades, it seemed that Warhol might have taken Reepin's advice and skipped loading film into the camera, as no movie starring the Velvet Underground and a sold-out Boston Tea Party audience was ever released. Reepin vaguely remembers Warhol intending to use the footage for a larger project called American Revolution. Then in 2009, the Andy Warhol Museum located the film canisters in its archives. The 33-minute, 16mm The Velvet Underground in Boston is disjointed, full of illogical cuts and zooms, and the band sounds muffled. Still, it's one of the only 2 pieces of film of the Velvet Underground during their original run, performing live with sync sound and the only one in color. Over the course of 1968, the Velvet Underground played the Boston Tea Party 15 times. They kicked things off in January with the release of their 2nd album, recorded in 2 days. The raucous, Nico-less, Warhol-free White Light, White Heat. On the back cover, in stark black and white, the band poses in front of the Boston Tea Party. Reepin booked them happily and frequently, though he still thinks they were a joke. In his memory, every junkie in Boston would show up to their shows because of the song Heroin, and Reed would always please the crowd by singing it. Reed was singing from experience, but the song had no connection to any current fix. According to a 1971 interview, he had tried the drug in his Syracuse University days, contracting hepatitis the very first time he shot up. This certainly didn't mean he stopped using other substances. By the time VU started routinely playing in Boston, amphetamines were the chemical of choice for Reed and 1 or 2 others in the band. In the 20th century, in a technological age living in the city, there are certain drugs you have to take just to keep yourself normal like a caveman, just to bring yourself up or down, Reed would later tell his most perceptive critic, Lester Bangs. They don't get you high, even. They just get you normal. "Jonathan, can you make this curve with your ring finger?" VU guitarist Sterling Morrison asked Jonathan Richman. Richman had brought his bingo prize guitar to the tea party and lingered in a corner of the dressing room until members of the band offered him something in the way of lessons. "They physically taught me how to play," he recounted. "That's where I got everything." The band eventually took to their 16-year-old mascot. Occasionally I drove them around in my father's car, Richmond recalled. I would go to some of the parties they'd go to. I was part of this crew. Another member of the crew, Robert Soma, reported that at a certain point Richmond even talked like Reed. His friendship with the band was genuine, he says. But here was this kid from Natick, suddenly speaking with a Long Island accent. I think Lou barely tolerated that, but was also kind of flattered. Richmond would later pen a mea culpa with his 2010 song, My Affected Accent. If the Velvets were busy, Richmond would wander through Cambridge and sometimes pick up an issue of Avatar. I wasn't sure I understood all of it, but could see they admired this Mel fellow, he says. Meanwhile, another young Velvet Underground fanatic was also reading Avatar, and he felt he understood everything it published, especially the Mel-centric pages. Wayne McGuire had been arrested and convicted for selling the paper in November 1967. For his loyalty, Lyman invited him and other salesmen to Fort Hill for a celebratory dinner, and McGuire dedicated himself to turning the population of Boston on to his guru's brilliance. Once the Velvets started frequenting the Tea Party, the band got rolled onto McGuire's hero roster, leading to his crawdaddy essay, The Boston Sound, easily the most intense endorsement of the Velvets to be published during their career. Now is the time for distortions to burn, McGuire screams via typewriter. With flaming sword in hand, I will clear away those ugly growths which parade as insightful musical criticism. This is a review of the Velvet Underground. This is a review of the end of the world. For all his raving, McGuire audaciously predicted their future fame as one of the primary mythmakers of our generation, and pinpointed the hard-to-explain dynamics of their trademark drone, in full display on White Light, White Heat. The drone, McGuire wrote, has two levels, high-pitched and low-pitched, corresponding to the drones of the central nervous systems, which are produced by two very heavy nervous systems belonging to Lou Reed and John Cale, respectively. The drone is not always heard, but rather felt as pure essence and perpetual presence. This jibed with Richmond's description of the band's live act. Your eyes would go from one person to the other, and you'd say, "Who's making that particular sound?" Richmond recalled in a 2013 radio interview. You'd hear this harmonic tone in the background. No one was betraying it by their facial expression. They were all just blandly playing their instrument. But there's this fifth, ghost tone, coming from somewhere. All these strange ghost tones. In the same breath, McGuire trashed MGM's Boston Sound campaign and suggested a direct connection between the Velvet Underground and Mel Lyman. They are merely vessels through which greater forces are working, and they listen attentively. In that moment before Reed became a legend and Lyman faded into obscurity, they revealed to McGuire the two paths open to an artist in Boston 1968. In 1976, Peter Loeffner paired the two together in his cream review of the first Modern Lovers album. Jonathan Richmond is nothing if not a Lou Reed protege, he wrote. Apparently, when the Velvets were sequestered in Boston's student ghetto in late 68, Jonathan found his guru in Lou. At least it wasn't Mel Lyman. It's possible that Reed and Lyman met. According to the Fort Hill community, the Velvet Underground sometimes spent the night in a Fort Avenue terrace house after a tea party show. On one such occasion, when Nico simply helped herself to someone's bed, the German singer was bluntly instructed to find somewhere else to get some sleep. Personnel from the band and a Fort Hill community member had certainly crossed paths at least once before. Faith Goode and VU's whip dancer, Gerard Malanga, had a brief affair in the early 60s. Malanga even wrote a poem about the unlikely free speech champion entitled simply Faith Frankenstein. McGuire's most groundbreaking insight into the Velvet Underground was that Reed's lyrics were about something more than surface-level depravities. All this time, you probably thought the Velvet Underground was talking about drugs, homosexuality, and sadomasochism, McGuire wrote. Look a bit closer. Sister Ray is not about shooting meth, fellatio, or murder. Rather, it is describing the greatest cosmic upheaval in the history of man, and you are living in the midst of it. Rob Norris had moved to Boston in March 1968, straight out of high school. Incredibly, because MGM's Boston Sound campaign had convinced him the city was going to be the next San Francisco. For $80 a month, he split a place on Mission Hill with some roommates. "I didn't really have to work," he says. "I just basically lived at the tea party." Norris met Lou Reed backstage at the tea party in 1968. The singer was scooping a sawdust-like substance out of a jar and into his mouth. They were the only two people in the back room. Reed stared at Norris before asking him if he was on amphetamines. Norris said no. Reed explained that the jar was full of wheat germ, which he gulped before shows, then subjected the young fan to an anti-drug rant. Norris mentioned that he had been in the audience at Summit High School in New Jersey 3 years prior, witness to the first Velvet Underground concert. Reed smiled, then happily introduced Norris to the rest of the band in the other room. He was there. As part of the VU's backstage club, Norris was shocked by how much astrology and the occult dominated the conversation. He recalls the janitor, de facto backstage manager at the tea party, a mystic statuesque presence named Mitch Blake, as being the resident expert. The campus stud at the University of New Hampshire, Blake underwent a transformation while working on a farm in New Hampshire, growing vegetables with prayer and working with a nature spirit. He and Lou became friends because of this interest in mysticism and astrology, Norris says. Lou was really into it. He was talking about kinds of healing that could be done with rays and levitation. He was very into healing, and he was very emphatic that white light, white heat could be taken two different ways. Blake concurs that around this time, one of Reed's chief artistic concerns was that his audience didn't understand his lyrics at all. This blew Norris's mind. If there was ever an obvious song about the thrills of an amphetamine rush, it was the album's rollicking title track. Yet Reed explained to Norris and Blake one night that while it definitely painted a scene of drugs and excess, it was also about enlightenment, Christian purity, and the healing power of white light, which Reed had discovered in a book called A Treatise on White Magic. The author, Alice Bailey, was a New Age pioneer who wrote 27 books on esoteric subjects before her death in 1949. Or rather, she claimed to transcribe the dictation of a Tibetan spirit, Jwal Kul. Of the many occult ideas found in her writing, Reed gravitated to her theory of the seven rays of energy. Seven forms of an intangible power were beaming down to Earth, Bailey wrote, which ray a human locked onto would determine much about their personality and future. It's not hard to imagine Reed studying Bailey, transforming second ray to sister ray. Norris theorizes that another song off the second album, I Heard Her Call My Name, might even be about Reed's intense attraction to Bailey's work. I know that she's long dead and gone. I heard her call my name. You will relax your physical body, endeavor to quiet your astral body as far as may be, and to steady the mind, Bailey wrote in A Treatise on White Magic. Call down a stream of pure white light, and pouring it through your lower vehicles, you will cleanse away all that hinders. Reed was unusually forthcoming about this side of his interests in a 1969 radio interview. When I was in L.A., I saw a reverend who reads your aura and tells you your previous incarnations and removes entities from you. I had an entity that had to be removed. I've been involved and interested in what they call white light for a long time. A woman named Alice Bailey, who has some rather remarkable books out, she was a telepathic secretary. It's kind of an incredible book, a treatise on white magic. It tells you how to go out and do it all. At the time, Reed was fond of passing along the treatise to people he felt were ready. Recipients include Billy Name, denizen of Warhol's factory, who designed the blacker-than-black cover of White Light, White Heat, and superfan Jonathan Richman. One of my big mistakes was turning him on to Alice Bailey. That's where that insect song comes from, Reed told Spin in 1986. I said, do you know, Jonathan, that insects are a manifestation of negative ego thoughts? That's on page 114. So he got that. That's a dangerous set of books. Both Reed and Richman would write about insects from the Bailey perspective, Reed with Ocean in late 68 or early 69. Insects are evil thoughts, thought of by selfish men. It nearly drives me crazy. And Richman in 76 with, Hey there, little insect, with the childlike request, Don't scare me so. Don't land on me and bite me, no. Richman's consumption of white magic helps explain what a song called Astral Plane is doing on his 1976 debut, The Modern Lovers. In an album largely about girl troubles and lovingly name-checking Boston locales, Astral Plane sticks out. But I'll prove my knowledge of what's inside, Richman sang, when I intercept you on the astral plane. As bassist Ernie Brooks told Vice, Jonathan was a big fan of Van Morrison's album Astral Weeks. That's such a beautiful record. I wasn't sure if Jonathan was actually able to do that, enter a girl's dream, but he really believed in it, which is where that song Astral Plane came from. The idea that you can communicate in another dimension with someone who's hard to reach in everyday life. He'd call me in the middle of the night saying about a girl we both knew, Ernie, I think I entered her dream. Do you think that's right? And I'd say, well, Jonathan, I guess it's okay. I don't know. Eventually, Van Morrison also found his way to Alice Bailey. Certainly, with an album called Astral Weeks, there's a chance that Morrison encountered her writings while in Boston, but concrete references to Bailey's work didn't show up in Morrison's songs until the 1980s. Morrison would later cryptically remark to a journalist that during his Boston residency, he visited an astrologer who passed along information that had stuck with him even years later. I'm a dweller on the threshold. Watch the great illusion drown, Morrison sang in 1982, initiating a three-album, three-year stretch in which he explicitly cited Bailey's teachings. Beautiful Vision even opens with its own Ray song, Celtic Ray. The liner notes for 1984's Inarticulate Speech of the Heart mention Bailey's book, Glamour, A World Problem. The illusion Morrison sings about in Dweller on the Threshold is what Bailey referred to as glamour, a mirage of fear, ignorance, and greed that traps the unenlightened. I've read Glamour four or five times, Morrison explained in 1982, and I get different things out of it each time. Morrison biographer Clinton Halen claims Morrison's early songwriting was, in part, a determined study of childhood visions. As a boy, Morrison's solitary hours were filled with deep, intense daydreams and even instances he would later classify as astral projection. Every now and then these experiences happen, he said in 1972. I'll be lying down on the bed with my eyes closed, And all of a sudden I get the feeling that I'm floating near the ceiling, looking down. Then in 1977, I had some amazing projections when I was a kid. You can have some amazing hallucinogenic experiences doing nothing but looking out your window. Morrison would later reflect that no one had been around to unpack these visions, and that songwriting had become a way to share these moments with others. Musician Clive Culbertson remarked that Morrison was a walking library of information about ritual magic, and writer Steve Turner reported that it wasn't unusual for a casual dinner with the singer to open with a question like, "What do you think about the blood of Jesus?" By the 1990s, Morrison had pulled out of the mystic, though maybe not by choice. When a friend brought up their old Bailey fixation, Morrison sadly replied, "I haven't got anybody to talk about that stuff anymore. Musicians don't know about that." There's no account of Reed and Morrison ever being close or bonding over Alice Bailey in 1968 or beyond, save for an aside at a shambolic 1996 gig at New York's Supper Club. Morrison wasn't connecting with the crowd. For over half an hour, he staved off requests for old songs, arguing with an audience member over whether he was a genius. Then, according to an MTV News story entitled "Van Morrison Guided by Voices," he mentioned unwanted visitations, and advice from someone who'd been through it as well. "I said, 'Lou, all this stuff is going on, all these noises, voices in my head all the time.' So he gave me the real rap. He says, 'You know what? When you hear the voices, you just say, that's not me. Just step back and say, that's not really me. That's somebody else.'" The Velvet Underground's debut as a four-piece rock band was a long time coming. Reed seemed hell-bent on cleaning house, and members' final performances with the band always seemed to happen in Boston. Nico and John Cale played their final sets with the Velvets at the Tea Party in 1967 and 1968, respectively. Nico knew something was wrong when she showed up characteristically late and tried to walk on stage near the end of the set. Reed wouldn't let her. The connection between the Velvets and Andy Warhol, the man who had given the band their initial notoriety, was severed in the summer of 1967 with the help of lawyers. "I'd never seen Andy angry, but I did that day," Lou Reed told David Frick in 1989. Despite the group's lack of commercial success, several parties vied for the manager position. In the end, they chose a sketchy young man named Steve Sesnick, who promised that popularity was just around the bend. Sesnick was from New York, but he was constantly visiting the Tea Party, trying to insert himself into the club's success. Later, he'd falsely claimed to be part owner. Sesnick so aggressively starved New York from the live VU experience that their old New York audience started showing up at the Tea Party. "You could tell," Steve Nelson says, "the Boston crowd would look all scruffy and messy, and then suddenly these hip people wearing furs and silks would walk in." Cale was the last to be excised on September 28, 1968. Sterling Morrison pinned the dismissal on Reed's jealousy. Cale blamed Sesnick's divisive nature and Reed's longing to push the band toward a more mainstream sound. The violist, bassist, had recently talked about placing their guitar amps underwater for the next album. With previously booked shows only a few weeks away, the search for a replacement began immediately. Doug Yule grew up in Great Neck, New York, but came to Massachusetts to attend Boston University in 1965. He began playing in cover bands soon after arriving, and in 1967 he joined the Grass Menagerie alongside Walter Powers and Willie Alexander, two lost refugees. Menagerie's manager found him an apartment on River Street in Cambridge, where Velvets, Morrison, and Reed occasionally crashed after playing the Tea Party. None of the band knew him well, and only Morrison had heard him play guitar before. But upon Sesnick's recommendation, Yule replaced Cale without an audition in the fall of 1968. With so little time before the next set of VU tour dates, there was no room for an exhaustive search. Just as important, perhaps, Reed was pleased that the astrological balance of his band would be preserved. Yule was a Pisces.